Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.12, The Committee of Union and Progress. Last time, we traced the initial rise of early opposition movements amongst Muslim elites of the Ottoman Empire, as young, disaffected bureaucrats began publishing critiques of the Ottoman administration within newspapers, journals, poems, novels, and plays. And this was kind of the first instance in which critiques of the government were written within these sorts of popular and widely accessible mediums. So this represents the moment when public opinion first arrived into Ottoman lands. This forging of public opinion within the Ottoman Empire was in many ways the most important contribution of this early group of dissenters, who would come to be referred to by historians as the Young Ottomans. The later generation of Young Turks would take up this mantle of reawakening Ottoman public opinion after Abdulhamid had successfully smothered the older generation of Young Ottomans during the 1880s when he tried to put this newfangled thing called public opinion back into the bottle, censoring newspapers and books, increasing surveillance with his new secret police, and shutting down oppositional groups. These repressive campaigns launched by Abdulhamid in the 1880s were in a lot of ways what ultimately separated the so-called Young Ottomans from the so-called Young Turks. Because the ideological divide between Young Ottomans and Young Turks is not at all clean, and the transition from the older generation of Young Ottomans to the younger generation of Young Turks happened pretty organically. In the end, this divide between the Young Turks and Young Ottomans was generational more than anything else, because the defining ideology of both groups was Ottomanism, the idea that the empire should be reformed in such a way as to become more unified, with the different religious groups of the empire being transformed into equal Ottoman citizens, whose loyalty was no longer to their religion or ethnic group, but instead to the Ottoman nation. Ottomanism was the core ideology of the Young Ottomans, and will continue to be one of the core ideologies of the later generation of Young Turks, who will look towards the Young Ottomans as heroes and martyrs in the great struggle against sultanic despotism. In the decades leading up to and following the Constitutional Revolution of 1908, the opposition movement to Sultan Abdulhamid will come to center around the group known to history as the Committee of Union and Progress, or the CUP for short. So in continuing our story of the Muslim opposition, we now turn to the founding of this committee that will one day establish complete one-party dictatorial rule over the Ottoman Empire and lead it through to its final collapse. The earliest roots of the Committee of Union and Progress can be traced back to the Royal Medical Academy in Istanbul. As Abdulhamid's reign became increasingly repressive in the 1880s, an anti-establishment movement would begin to emerge within the royal colleges of the empire, and this student opposition movement would become most pronounced within the Royal Medical Academy. And medical doctors will go on to play a major role in the revolutionary movement, especially early on. And if the French Revolution was defined by the ongoing presence of lawyers, just everywhere you look, lawyers left and right, then the Young Turk Revolution will be defined by the ongoing presence of doctors. Everywhere you look, just doctors left and right. And the reason that it would be the medical schools where the nucleus of the Young Turks would first form largely stems from the influence of a scientific movement called biological materialism within the curricula of the empire's medical schools. Okay, so what in the heck is biological materialism, and why does it matter? The late 19th century was a time when the European intellectual world running from Istanbul to Paris was getting pretty pumped about science. There was a growing sense amongst many educated elites of the time that everything, and I mean everything, could be explained through science, and that religion, philosophy, and mysticism were just a bunch of unverifiable nonsense. The central figure in this budding movement was Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution. Many scientists and philosophers of the time came to feel that the theory of evolution had dealt the ultimate death blow to creationism, and therefore to the major Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Here was a very convincing scientific theory that successfully explained one of life's greatest mysteries. How did we get here? For Darwin, it was simple. We started as tiny microorganisms, and then over time, everything slowly mutated and evolved through a process of natural selection to become trees, flowers, birds, lions, insects, and humans. And well, as I am sure you are all very aware, the ability of evolution to explain the existence of life was a pretty big win for science and an equally big loss for religion and mystic philosophy. What this meant is that in the century following Darwin, more and more academics began to apply Darwin's ideas to other things. And this is, of course, where you get social Darwinism, which will be a very important foundation stone for the later ideology of the Young Turks, as they become more and more radically nationalist after assuming power. The first seed of this Darwinian nationalism would be planted right here in the medical schools of Istanbul. So in sum, biological materialism is essentially the idea that you can explain everything about existence through biology, chemistry, and physics. And such ideas were the latest and greatest in scientific thought at the time. So naturally, biological materialism was taught at the medical colleges of the Ottoman Empire. And the reason that this would lead medical students to begin to form pockets of political opposition to the Sultan is because, as we know, Abdulhamid had tried very hard to bring Islamic fundamentalism back because pan-Islam was a central part of his imperial rule. Remember, Sultan Abdulhamid began to deploy the unifying power of Islam in an effort to hold together his fracturing empire by strengthening the bonds between Arabs, Albanians, Kurds, Circassians, Turks, and so on. What we need to keep in mind here is that this turn towards Islamic fundamentalism was seen by many Ottoman elites as an effort to wind the clock back to a time of ignorant superstition. Because as we touched upon last week, a big part of the Tanzimat reforms of the 19th century had been the introduction of Western secular thought to Ottoman lands. And along with French literature and political philosophy, this would also include the introduction of Western science. And early on, Western science actually gained even more traction amongst Ottoman intellectuals than European political philosophy. And this was because during the Tanzimat era, it came to be pretty widely believed within Ottoman elite circles that the reason why Europe had made so many advances in the past century was specifically because of Western science. And so, round about the 1850s, academic thought and scholarly discourse came to be dominated by a scientific point of view rather than a religious point of view. Now, the tension between religious thought and scientific thought would follow a very different trajectory in Ottoman lands than in the Christian nations of Western Europe. And an anecdotal example that is kind of interesting and helps to highlight this difference, the word that had always been used to describe scientific thought was the same word that was used to describe religious thought. Among Ottoman intellectuals, the Arabic word ilma, which essentially just means knowledge, was used to refer to inquiries into both science and religion. So in Ottoman circles, there was initially a much smoother transition from the religion of God to the religion of science. And this had a lot to do with the nature of Islam, which historically had been much more open to other forms of knowledge and inquiry than was Christianity. And in a couple of weeks, we will be doing a full episode on Islamic political and scientific philosophy, so more on all of this later. Of course, the rise of scientific secular thought in Ottoman lands would inevitably lead to a clash between the defenders of traditional religion and the defenders of scientific progress. But throughout much of the 19th century, there was a growing sense amongst Ottoman intellectuals that Western-style science was the future and religious fundamentalism was the past. Okay, I know I am oversimplifying this an insane amount, and Islam continued to play a major role in Ottoman society and imperial governance throughout the Tanzimat era. And now that we are shifting our focus towards the Muslim opposition, we will have to take some time to closely investigate the relationship between Islam as a religion, Islam as a political philosophy and code of laws, and Islam as a philosophical mode of inquiry. Because within the Islamic world, the dualistic separation between things like religion and the state, or religion and science, just simply do not have the same meaning as they do in Western countries influenced by Judeo-Christian and secular traditions. From its very earliest days, Islam was both a religion as well as a political mode of governance and an intellectual and oftentimes scientific modus operandi. To put it extremely simply for now, because again we are coming back to this in a couple weeks, things like the separation of church and state and the rivalry between religion and science just didn't have the same meaning in Islamic countries, and this was especially true in the 19th century before such Western concepts had become so widespread. So it is important to understand from the outset that for Western observers, like myself, we have to check a lot of our intellectual baggage at the door. And an illuminating example of this can actually be found amongst the young Ottomans who we discussed last week. Because along with promoting the doctrine of Ottomanism, the young Ottomans were also early proponents of Islamic modernism, the idea that Islam should be updated and reinvigorated in order to adapt to the new challenges faced in the modern world. Islamic modernism is going to become super duper important, especially in the years directly following World War I, as the Islamic world grapples with the fall of the Ottoman Caliphate and the subsequent introduction of widespread European imperialism throughout the Muslim world. The defining question of Islamic modernism was basically, how should Muslims respond to Western modernization and European colonial domination? And this was also in many ways the defining question facing young Ottomans like Namik Kemal, Ibrahim Sanyasi, and Midhat Pasha. So even though these figures are often cited as being proto-Turkish nationalists, they were also proto-Islamic modernists. And this is especially illuminating because one of the biggest splits in the Islamic world following World War I will come to center around the divide between secular nationalism and Islamic fundamentalism. For the young Ottomans who were active 50 years before this rupture, there really wasn't any issue because they argued that Islam was in fact completely compatible with Western science and with Western forms of government. And this is why you would hear Midhat Pasha say things like, "In Islam, the principle of government rests upon bases essentially democratic, inasmuch as the sovereignty of the people is therein recognized." For Islamic modernists like the young Ottomans and Midhat Pasha, the early Islamic communities founded by the Prophet Muhammad were inherently egalitarian and democratic, and the golden age of Islam during the Middle Ages had been defined by a focus on rational thought, which had led to very significant breakthroughs in science, medicine, philosophy, and politics. So, for these early Islamic modernists, the problem was not Islam itself, but what Islam had become in recent centuries as it had been co-opted by imperial regimes and despotic sultans who put religious scholars and Islamic judges on the imperial payroll with the purpose of simply deploying Islam as a tool for keeping the masses ignorant and for upholding their own autocratic rule. Okay. So with all of that said, the Tanzimat era had put a new emphasis on Western-style secularism, and this new focus on scientific thinking had a major impact on the way people thought within elite circles. Politically speaking, Tanzimat reformers had, in their effort to modernize the empire, severely curtailed the influence of these religious scholars and Islamic judges. And the power that these religious leaders had over politics was in many ways lost to Western-facing secularists, who began proselytizing about the potential benefits of adopting Western-style political thought and scientific methods. These Western-facing secularists would form a new generation of bureaucrats whose power in Ottoman politics would come to be symbolized in the literal physical building of the Sublime Porte, which would emerge as the new center of power within Ottoman diplomacy and governance. To summarize, during the Tanzimat era, the power of the new bureaucracy at the Sublime Porte began to eclipse the power of the religious scholars and Islamic judges. But then, of course, here comes Sultan Abdul Hamid in 1876. And though it is not exactly correct to think of Abdul Hamid as winding back Western-style modernization, he definitely began to check the power of the Sublime Porte bureaucracy as he built his more autocratic style of rule based on personal loyalty. And the Sultan also began to reincorporate Islamic rhetoric and religious rituals as he sought to heighten his legitimacy as an absolute ruler, placing new emphasis on his role as the Islamic caliph, spiritual leader of the broader Islamic world. Now, this move by Abdul Hamid to deploy pan-Islam and put new emphasis on his role as caliph was yet another example of his adroit politicking. Because, as we just said, the young Ottomans themselves had just pushed for further unity between the different Islamic groups of the empire, and a central aspect of Islamic modernism was developing this emergent ideology of pan-Islam. So, in a lot of ways, Abdul Hamid simply co-opted this aspect of Islamic modernism from the young Ottomans as he built his updated version of sultanic rule, redefining Ottomanism as exclusively Islamic rather than as including all the subjects of the empire. And then, of course, Abdul Hamid had also quietly dropped the part where the young Ottomans had argued that the true Islam was in fact democratic and rational, as Abdul Hamid had done away with the 1876 Midhat Constitution and reinvented his inherited role as the Islamic caliph, using this position as the leader of the Muslim world in order to solidify his more personalized style of autocracy. So these were the kind of things that offended many Ottoman elites who came to oppose Abdul Hamid in the 1880s. Because it sure seemed like he was trying to reassert an outdated style of despotic rule that hadn't been seen since before the Tanzimat. This was made all the more infuriating by the fact that Abdul Hamid had been put into power by these very same Western-facing secularists, whom he later would come to repress. Because you may remember that one of the first moves Sultan Abdul Hamid made in his effort to solidify his personalized rule was to exile, arrest, and then secretly organize the assassination of former Grand Vizier Midhat Pasha, who was widely recognized as being sympathetic to the young Ottomans, and who was the primary conspirator who had brought Abdul Hamid to power in the first place. As we said last week, the young Ottomans had initially hoped that Abdul Hamid would introduce a more enlightened style of rule to the Ottoman Empire, but instead he had introduced autocracy and done away with their leader. The exile, arrest, and assassination of Midhat Pasha in 1883 was a major symbolic moment in the rule of Abdul Hamid, as the Sultan had successfully done away with the most powerful leader of the liberal opposition and the last great statesman of the Tanzimat era. When Midhat Pasha died, the power of the Sublime Porte bureaucracy, the influence of the young Ottomans, and the hope of representative government in the Ottoman Empire died with him. Okay, so with that very long-winded backdrop, we now come back to the students of the Royal Medical Academy. Like we have said, the Tanzimat had been an era of great interest in Western science and rational thought, and this was perhaps most pronounced in the medical schools of the empire. So when Sultan Abdul Hamid began to introduce heavier censorship into Ottoman universities, many students would resist this process as much as they could. Biological materialism was of special significance here, because biological materialism was based in Western scientific discourse, and it came in direct conflict with Abdul-Hamid's brand of Islamic fundamentalism, as it sought to explain existence through physics, chemistry, and biology, rather than through philosophy, mysticism, and religion. So, amidst a more general wave of student resistance within the empire's universities in response to Abdul-Hamid's introduction of tighter censorship, a group of students at the Royal Medical Academy would decide to put together a secret organization with the loose goal of opposing Abdul-Hamid's autocratic regime. On June the 2nd, 1889, four leaders from this student movement at the Royal Medical College formed what was initially called the Ottoman Union Society. And after many twists and turns, this initially very small seed planted at the medical college in Istanbul would flower into the very large and very important Committee of Union and Progress, or the CUP. The original founders of the CUP, which, by the way, I will often just say CUP because the group will go through a whole lot of name changes, I am sure, just to make things extra confusing for future history podcasters. But the original founders of the CUP were four students whose names I am going to give you, because they will go on to be important within Ottoman politics, though, as we will see, not necessarily within the CUP, but oftentimes in direct opposition to the CUP, which should foreshadow some of the inner party conflict and fierce backbiting that is to come. The original founders of the CUP were Ibrahim Timo, Abdullah Chevdet, Mehmed Rashid, and Ishak Shakuti. And again, foreshadowing future divisions, amongst these original founders of the CUP, the group that will become the heart of the so-called Young Turk movement, not a single one of these original founders was actually ethnically Turkish. Ibrahim Timo was an Ottoman Albanian who had become active in politics following the chaos of the Russo-Turkish War of 1877, which had set off a crisis in Albania as unrest and outright revolt had broken out amongst the Albanians when it was feared that the great powers would annex their home country. I promise, we will be talking more about the Albanians, just not right now. But Ibrahim Timo, he began as an Albanian political activist and then later founded the CUP. Next is Abdullah Chevdet, who was an Ottoman of Kurdish ethnic heritage originally from eastern Anatolia, hailing from one of those Kurdish communities who had left nomadic life and settled in the towns and cities of eastern Anatolia. Abdullah Chevdet had grown up as a devout Muslim, but through his education, he had become heavily influenced by biological materialism. As a previously devout Muslim who became secularized, Abdullah Chevdet would hold a point of view that would become increasingly common within the ranks of the CUP, whose members would seek to strike a balance between secularism and Islam. Chevdet's point of view can be best summarized in a quote in which he said, "Although the Muslim God is of no use in the modern era, Islamic society must preserve Islamic principles." And you can really hear the echoes of Islamic modernism in this quote. And these early Young Turks were, much like their young Ottoman predecessors, eminently concerned with how to best introduce Western reform while still maintaining the unique Islamic character of the Ottoman Empire. This idea of creating a secular society based around Islamic principles is going to become hugely important, not only for the future of the CUP and the Ottoman Empire, but for the future direction of politics within the Muslim world more generally. The central question for secularists like Abdullah Chevdet would be, how do we adopt the benefits of Western science while still maintaining our distinct Islamic culture? Okay, third up is Ishak Shakuti, another Kurd from eastern Anatolia, who will in time become a critical link between this old guard of the CUP in Istanbul and the new guard centered around Ahmed Reza in Paris, who we will more fully introduce next week. And then fourth was Mehmed Reshid, who is probably the most controversial figure amongst these original founders, as Mehmed Reshid will, unlike the other three founders, stick with the CUP all the way up to and through the Armenian Genocide, an event he will take a very active part in. Mehmed Reshid was actually originally from the Russian Empire, hailing from one of those Muslim communities around the Black Sea, who had faced fierce repression at the hands of the Russian imperial government. So, as a very young child, Mehmed Reshid was amongst those Circassian refugees we discussed during the Armenian series, who flooded into Ottoman lands in the 1870s in order to escape the persecution of the murderous Russian imperial army. So again, it's Ibrahim Timo, an Albanian, Abdullah Chevdet and Ishak Shukuti, both Kurds, and Mehmed Reshid, a Circassian. Initially, all of these original founders were mostly concerned with discussing how they could halt the seemingly never-ending decline of the Ottoman Empire. As members of the now submerged class of Western-facing secularists, these early founders quickly unified around the idea of bringing the 1876 Constitution of Midhat Pasha back, feeling that the reinstatement of representative government was the necessary prerequisite for saving the empire from both Abdul Hamid's absolutism and from the foreign encroachment of the imperialistic Western powers. So from the very beginning, the reinstatement of Midhat's 1876 constitution was the raison d'etre of the CUP. For the rest of 1889, the CUP's founders would host a few preliminary meetings as they began to secretly recruit members at the medical school and at other universities throughout Istanbul. In these early days, Ibrahim Timo was the most active in recruiting, and through his tireless efforts, the society quickly began to grow in size. Then, in 1890, the CUP would hold its first official public meeting. And following their heroes from the French Revolution, this inaugural meeting would be held under the guise of a good old banquet. And this banquet would take place at a vineyard previously owned by none other than Midhat Pasha. And the decision to hold this banquet at the vineyard of the former Grand Vizier and mastermind of the 1876 Constitution was very intentional. For the founders of the CUP, Midhat Pasha was nothing less than a legend. This meeting at Midhat Pasha's vineyard was the moment when the CUP was transformed from being a small group of radical students to being a full-blown secret society. Present at this banquet were not only medical students, but also imperial bureaucrats, because Ibrahim Timo had successfully infiltrated several different government ministries. At this meeting, members were given numerical identifications, with Ibrahim Timo being given 1/1, and the other original founders received 1/2, 1/3, etc. A complex organizational framework was then designed for the committee, and this party structure was modeled off of a hodgepodge of other revolutionary groups. At the banquet, Ibrahim Timo expounded upon the benefits of integrating the secretive structure of the Greek Felikia Tyria, which in the years leading up to the Greek Revolution had developed a secret language, kept membership hidden from lower-ranking members, and held ritualistic initiation ceremonies. Then another member suggested that they model themselves off of the Russian Narodists, that countercultural movement whose members had fed into people's will and into the Russian Marxist groups. And then there has also been a lot of speculation amongst historians about the influence of the Italian Carbonari on the CUP. And while there is less direct evidence for this, it is still very likely that the CUP founders were at least aware of the Carbonari and also looked to them for inspiration. But it is important to note that these revolutionary groups, the Felikia Tyria, the Narodists, and the Carbonari, primarily provided inspiration for the CUP in terms of their secret organizational structure, meaning that the influence had less to do with ideology or revolutionary goals. Because honestly, at this point, the CUP was still working out their ideology and goals, having not thought that far beyond simply wanting to oppose Abdul Hamid, reinstate the Meadhat Constitution, continue modernizing the empire, and reintroduce representative government. Throughout the early 1890s, the CUP would focus their efforts on aggressively recruiting members, with the first batch of recruits being pulled from the Royal School of Administration and the Royal War Academy. And these three academies, the Medical Academy, the School of Administration, and the War Academy, nicely illustrate the general makeup of the CUP in its early years, as members were usually young doctors, young imperial bureaucrats, and young junior army officers. And these young, lower-ranking officials would use their insider positions to try and recruit members who were higher up in the imperial chain of command. And they actually had a lot of success in this effort, as many, many administrators and officers had also grown to dislike the autocratic style of Abdulhamid and saw membership in the CUP as a great opportunity to resist it. So the CUP basically began targeting members of the old Tanzimat bureaucracy at the Spline Port. The former followers of Midhat Pasha, whose power had been checked by Abdulhamid in the 1880s. Even though the CUP would go to great lengths to keep their activities a secret, Abdulhamid's secret police became aware of their existence almost immediately, likely because they were literally trying to recruit bureaucrats from the Sultan's administration. And the committee's founder, Ibrahim Timo, had actually been arrested in the summer of 1890, even before the banquet at the vineyard of Midhat Pasha. But in these early days, the Sultan would maintain a somewhat lenient policy because the palace mostly viewed all of this as like an annoying and harmless student movement. So Ibrahim Timo was quickly released after being briefly interrogated at Yildiz Palace. And seeing as he went on to become member 1/1 of the CUP just a couple of months later, I think we can safely say that Ibrahim Timo did not really learn any lessons from this run-in with the Sultan's secret police. As the CUP continued to gain influence amongst the students at the Royal Academies and amongst low-ranking bureaucrats and officers at the Spline Port, the Sultan did grow increasingly concerned about their activities. So in 1894, the palace reorganized the Royal Academies to put them under tighter surveillance. And then they dispatched several spies to infiltrate the CUP. And after this surveillance mission, these student spies came back to the secret police and reported that, quote, all students at the Royal Medical Academy had ideas against the establishment. The school is full of banned publications, and in the near future, seditious activities will be undertaken. And well, after hearing this, the palace decided that they needed to take action. The Sultan's secret police launched a campaign of arrests and began searching through the personal belongings of students at the royal universities. And during these raids, the authorities even found copies of, gasp, works by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So yeah, these students are clearly up to no good. But in all seriousness, this little anecdote does give you an idea of how in the early days of the CUP, the movement was kind of limited to a bunch of college students trying to read banned books and, like, secretly put up posters of Midhat Pasha and Prince Murad in their dorm room. But these initial arrests would force several students to flee to Europe and to Egypt, beginning a process that would, over the coming years, eventually see hundreds of exiles being forced to leave the Ottoman Empire and to set up shop in European cities, such as Geneva and Paris, as well as in Cairo, where they would be offered the protection of the British. Now, in the coming years, these emigre circles will become the incubator for the Young Turk vanguard. But we will focus on the doings of the exiles in Paris and Geneva more closely next week, keeping our focus today on the Istanbul Center. This initial spat of arrests really only drove the CUP members who remained in the imperial capital to further accelerate their recruiting efforts. And it was during this time that the CUP made initial contact with some very important people, like Ahmed Reza and Murad Bey, the two figures who will emerge as the leaders of the Young Turk emigre scene in Paris and Geneva in the coming years. Then things began to get very real very fast in the summer of 1895, because as we know from having just covered the Armenian resistance, the summer of 1895 was when the Hunchaks led their march down to the Sublime Porte, which had set off a pogrom in Constantinople, and these events reverberated all across the empire and led the Hamidian massacres to begin in earnest. The Hamidian massacres put a big, giant international spotlight on Sultan Abdulhamid's government, and the CUP did everything they could to use the crisis surrounding the Armenian massacres to launch broadsides against the Sultan's regime. The CUP began distributing leaflets amongst soldiers at the military academy and amongst sailors at the naval academy. And these leaflets deeply criticized the Sultan and said things like, "Your predecessors helped the people. Are you sleeping?" Then, during the Armenian demonstration outside of the Sublime Porte, CUP founders Ibrahim Timo and Ishak Shakuti distributed pamphlets, with the majority of these pamphlets given out at mosques as they called on all Muslims to take revolutionary action against Abdulhamid. And then, as the crisis deepened in the capital, the CUP began to distribute pamphlets that called on Muslims and Christians to unite against their common enemies, the Red Sultan and his cronies. Even though these were very powerful criticisms of the Sultan made at a time when Abdulhamid was extremely vulnerable, the Sultan would make it out of the crisis of the Hamidian massacres with his power still intact. And perhaps most importantly, Abdulhamid successfully avoided a significant great power intervention. Because while the great powers did help negotiate deals between the Armenian revolutionaries and the imperial government, no significant diplomatic or military advance was made against the Ottomans as a result of the massacres. So, by 1896, the Sultan had some breathing room, and he would take the opportunity to initiate a giant campaign of investigations and arrests into the CUP. And in the months that followed, it is estimated that nearly 900 people were arrested during this repressive campaign. These arrests would include all of the original founders of the CUP. So, Abdullah Cevdet and Mehmed Reshid were both arrested and exiled. Ibrahim Timo was forced to flee to Romania. Ishak Shakuti avoided arrest for the longest of anyone, but he too was eventually apprehended and exiled to Rhodes. Before Ishak Shakuti was arrested, though, he would officially transfer the leadership of the CUP to a fellow comrade and fellow doctor still living in the capital. And after some back and forths and several shakeups, the CUP would actually end up being taken over by a very high-ranking bureaucrat in the Imperial War Office. And through this connection, the CUP in Istanbul would, in pretty short order, come to be made up almost entirely of high-level diplomats, top-tier military officers, influential religious scholars, and even a few ministers serving directly under the Sultan. So, through his effort to crack down on the CUP, the Sultan had inadvertently transformed the Istanbul branch of the CUP from being a student group to being a secret oppositional faction made up of high-ranking government officials. And as weird as it might sound, this new cohort in the imperial capital had basically zero connection to the original CUP founders. And from his exile in Romania, Ibrahim Timo admitted that he didn't even know the new leader of the CUP. But the point is, some very powerful people had now taken over the operational structure of the committee in the imperial capital. And this was a very dangerous situation for Abdulhamid. As more and more high-ranking officials began joining the committee, the Imperial War Office essentially transformed into the center of CUP operations in Istanbul. And at the same time that the imperial bureaucracy was being infiltrated by the CUP, European public opinion was once again turning against the Sultan as a result of the continued violence against Armenians in early 1896. And all of this was feeling eerily similar to 1876, when European public opinion surrounding the Bulgarian horrors had precipitated the Great Eastern Crisis and eventually led to the series of coups that had placed Abdulhamid on the throne. So everyone began to expect some sort of coup to take place amidst the general feeling of apocalypse and mass chaos. In September of 1896, just a month after the Daşnak Bank takeover, generalized unrest began to grip Istanbul as religious students began to demonstrate against the Sultan and as the Armenian Daşnaks continued to agitate in the capital, distributing leaflets calling upon Muslims to unite with them in an effort to overthrow the Sultan. So, the high-ranking officials of the newly organized CUP decided that the moment was now ripe for a coup, and so planning began in earnest. However, because this coup was being discussed amongst so many people in such high levels of office, the plans were leaked to the Sultan and his secret police. As a result, another massive campaign of arrests was initiated by the palace, and around 350 people were apprehended and exiled to remote parts of the empire and abroad. But this latest wave of arrests was not perpetrated against students and young professionals, but against some of the highest-ranking military officers, bureaucrats, police chiefs, and religious scholars in the capital, including the military commander of Istanbul, the police commissioner, and the commander of the imperial gendarmerie. So, the Sultan had once again successfully stamped out the opposition in the imperial capital, and this time, the Istanbul branch of the CUP would not be able to make a significant comeback. But even though the failed coup of 1896 would be a major setback, it would certainly not be the end of the Young Turk movement. And now that Istanbul had proven to be quite an unwelcoming place for the enemies of the Sultan, the center of operations for the CUP would move abroad as the branches in Paris, Geneva, and Cairo emerged as the new centers of the opposition movement. And these new centers in Europe and Egypt were now just absolutely brimming with exiles from all walks of Ottoman life, as literally thousands of exiled students, doctors, professors, lawyers, religious scholars, bureaucrats, police, and military officers began to swell the ranks of the CUP's emerging emigre movement, and living safely under the protection of the governments of Europe. The Young Turks would feel newly emboldened to launch even harsher rhetorical onslaughts against Abdul Hamid. So, next week, we will turn our attention to this emigre movement and focus on the figure who will emerge as the most persistent thorn in the Sultan's side, Ahmed Reza. So, join me next time as we follow the Young Turks in Exile.